2, the reason we want to be looking back at Leviticus 23 and at Deuteronomy 16, and you may want to make a note somewhere about those chapters, because those are the chapters that talk about the three most important annual feasts for Israel. So Leviticus 23 and Deuteronomy 16. And the reason we want to look at those is what we read in verse 41 of Luke 2. And it says, now his parents went to Jerusalem every year for the feast of what? Passover. Feast of Passover. And that is an annual feast. So let's look back at Leviticus 23. There actually are three and key or most important annual feasts. So look at Leviticus 23. So starting in verse 4, or really verse 5, so the first month of the year, and the Jewish calendar begins in sometime around like March, spring. And so when it says the first month, you're talking about sometime in the spring. March, April. And the reason it's hard for us to pin that down, we have a solar calendar and they have a lunar calendar. They follow the cycles of the moon. The moon cycles in a different number of days. I don't want to spend all the time talking about that, but if you research that, if you want to see the difference between those, what I will add, what happens in the Jewish calendar is every so many years they have an extra month. Because you have to catch up on those, because it's like 28, I want to say it's 28 and a half days, something like that, is a lunar cycle. But notice verse 5, it is the first day of the week, and what, first month of the year. And notice what is this called? What is this feast called in Leviticus 23, verse 6? What are they? So it's called, yeah. So verse 5, it's the Lord's Passover. Verse 6, it's the Feast of the Unleavened Bread. So there's it's a week long observance. There's one, and so that's many Jews then would go to Jerusalem, and the population of Jerusalem, as you might imagine, would swell during this time of the week of Passover. Now, why is that important? Because when you get to the Gospels, if you remember the Gospel accounts of the crucifixion of Jesus, that happens during what week? So the Feast of Passover. Now, if you look at Leviticus 23, starting in verse 9, here is another annual feast. And how is it referred to here?
First fruits.
Yeah, the first fruits, or the Feast of Weeks, sometimes it's referred to. Any of you, do you see anywhere the idea of Feast of Weeks? The key thing is verse 16, and that is, so you count from Passover, and how many days?
50 days.
So it's 7 weeks, 7 times 7, 49, and then it begins on the 50th day, which is the other name for that is Pentecost. And so, again, you have that like in the book of Acts. So this is 50 days after the death, burial, resurrection of Jesus. 50 days later, then you have the Spirit is poured out, and there is the day of Pentecost, the first gospel sermon Peter preaches. But that is associated with this feast that we're looking at starting in verse 15. Leviticus 23. Now, the other one is Leviticus 23, verse 33. How does yours describe that? What is it called there? The Feast of Booths, or some will say the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, what's a tabernacle? Little portable building, like a covered, like a one word you might think of is arbor. If you go out north of Robert Lee toward Colorado City, toward Silver, some of you may have gone out that way. If you take that road, I think it's Highway 208. If you take 208, if you watch, I forgot how many miles it is, but there is what's called the Sanco Loop, S-A-N-C-O. Watch for this. There's a sign there, I think, that says that. There's a little loop that runs out there. And there's actually a little place called Sanco. It's my understanding is they were trying to say Sonico. That was the name of an Indian chief. And they messed up, and it says Sanco. But for a lot of years, there was an annual tabernacle meeting out there, religious meeting of all different groups of religions. But they would meet out there and have a revival out at Sanco. And I remember still the first time driving out there, there was still a cover out there. They had built a cover like that. Now, so it's variously described as booths, tabernacles. A tabernacle is a, as Fritz said, it's a portable, movable cover. The tabernacle is the tent of meeting that traveled with Israel through the 40 years of wandering and then beyond. And so they're on the move, so that's why they have a tabernacle. So that's the distinction between, what's the difference between tabernacle and temple? The temple doesn't move. It's made, it's permanent. It's built in Jerusalem. And so it replaces the tabernacle. But the tabernacle is what they had originally. And tabernacle means tent. It's a big tent. And so tabernacles... So here's the Feast of Booths or Tabernacles is during the harvest of the grapes and what? Olives. Grapes and olives would be harvested in the fall. At Pentecost, it's also a harvest, but it's the grain harvest. And so the Feast of Booths. Yeah, I think there's even a practical aspect to the Feast of Booths. And that is, it's for the same reason that there are people that camp out in California, my understanding is, at certain times of the year in the avocado groves. Yeah, so why would you suppose they would do that?
She asked me
why. Yeah. Because they're stupid? Okay, there's one idea. It's because when they are ripe, they have people that stay out there to keep them from being stolen. Yeah. And so there may be a practical aspect to this that you have the Feast of Booths during the harvest of the olives and the grapes because it's also you can protect your crop. Maybe that's part of it. You wonder that. But it's a celebration. And they're celebrating the fact that they have a harvest. And the celebration is... You're thanking God that God's blessed you. And you think about what would that do for these people? What should it be doing? It should remind them that if they prosper, they prosper because God has blessed them. It's not because of their own strength and their own ability. So it's the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, so that one, obviously, you don't go to Jerusalem for the Feast of Tabernacles or Booths. It's on your farm. You go out in the country. And you would imagine it's probably a good family time. I mean, you think about that. You go camping once a year out on the farm. I think there's something distinctive about each one of these feasts. Now, look at Deuteronomy 16. You may notice, Deuteronomy repeats a lot of things. It's the fifth book of Moses, and it repeats a lot of things that have already been said. And the reason is, if you go back to the book of Deuteronomy and you read the very first verses, where are we at? What's going on here? You read Deuteronomy 1, where are we at? What's the time sequence, or what's happened now at this point? They've crossed the Jordan, and they actually have gone 40 years of training. Deuteronomy is the end of the 40 years in the wilderness, if you read Deuteronomy 1. And so there is a new generation that has now been raised up, and that's why, you're aware, I guess. You've noticed before, like, the Ten Commandments are given twice. The first time's in Exodus 20, when they've just been rescued out of Egypt. The rescue out of Egypt's Exodus 13 and 14. They sing and celebrate that in Exodus 15. In Exodus 20 is the first time they give the Ten Commandments. Deuteronomy 5, the Ten Commandments are given again. Why? Recall, because it's a new generation. It's a new generation that were not there on that day. And so it is being re-emphasized to them in Deuteronomy 5. This is the new generation. You remember everybody that was a certain age and older have died during that 40 years. And this is a new generation that has now been raised up. And it's a reminder to them, this is not just the old folks' story. This is your story. You're part of this story. And so that's what's going on. That's why you have repetition. So like Leviticus 23, some of those same things now are brought up again in Deuteronomy 16. So look at Deuteronomy 16. Verse 1, what's the feast?
Passover.
Notice he says, it's a reminder God rescued you out of Egypt. That's interesting, because this is at the oldest people are the little ones that were little kids when this happened. God rescued you, and so you offer this offering at Jerusalem at the temple, or the ideal is, if not that, then in your home. So you've got Deuteronomy 16, verse 1. Is the Feast of Passover. Deuteronomy 16, what's the next feast? Verse 9. Weeks. Notice he says, here's how you figure this. You count 7 weeks, so how many days? 49 days, and then, and notice it's associated with what kind of, the harvest of what? Grain. It's the grain harvest. And you keep the Feast of Weeks on the day after that 7th week's 50th day, notice it's a you share with the vulnerable people. Verse 11, who do you share the meals, the food, who do you feast with? Your servants, your family, the Levite, Because remember, the Levites are scattered throughout all 12 of the tribes. They don't. There's not a tribe. If you look at the map of the 12 tribes of Israel, there's not a tribe of Levi because they get dispersed throughout all of the tribes. The sons of Joseph gets a double portion. You remember the names of Joseph's sons? Ephraim and Manasseh. And that's so there are two tribes that are associated with Joseph. So you notice, who else do you ask? You ask the foreigners, the immigrants. You ask the migrants to join you in the feast. And you ask the orphans to your feast. And you ask the widows to your feast. Those are the three most vulnerable people in the society. And so you look out for the people in the weakest position, the most vulnerable people, the most likely to be poor, that you and you share with them. And notice verse 12. What does he say is the reason you should do that? You used to be vulnerable yourself, didn't you? Slaves in a vulnerable position or a weak position. They don't get to call very many shots. And he says, you know, you used to be slaves, so that's why you should be watchful for people that are vulnerable, that may need your help. Notice verse 13. And there's the feast of what? The booths. Here's the tabernacles, the booths, the arbors. Here's the camping out feast. So again, and notice what harvest is associated with that one in verse 13. Grapes. See, it's grapes and olives. That's the fall harvest. So you've got grain harvest at Pentecost, and you've got grapes and olives at the Feast of Booths. But again, notice who you share with when you have that feast, verse 14. Same group. Come on over. We're going to have a feast, and you need to join us. Notice the stress here in verse 16. 7 days you'll keep the feast at the place the Lord will choose, because the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce and in all the work of your hands, so that you may be what? Mine says joyful. This is verse 15. Joy. There. This is a very joyful week of celebration. We're camping out. We're asking all the folks to come. And we're going to have a good time. So, anybody ever ask, is it a good thing to camp out? Well, God thought it was good for Israel.
I think it's interesting. In our peace, the joy will make the joy complete.
It will finish out your joy. Yeah, that's interesting. How else does yours read there?
Rejoice.
So anyway, that's the background to what we read in Luke 22, verse 41. Luke chapter 2, verse 41. That, and what does it say about Joseph and Mary? If you come back to Luke chapter 2, verse 41, what does it say about them? That they, it says that they make an annual trip. It's in our budget. It's in our family budget. We're going to make this trip every year. They observe the Passover regularly. And apparently, based on the story, as we read this before, I'll read it here in just a minute, a few of these verses. But it's. I think there's some joy here, because part of it is the trip from Galilee to Judah. And who are they traveling with? It's family. It's a big family caravan. It's kind of like everybody gets in their vans and heads out. And only they're walking. But so, and it's probably, you're talking about probably a 3-day walk.
Here to Abilene.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like walking from here to Abilene.
And you're going to knock it out in 3 days.
Well, they're accustomed to walking. They're accustomed to walking. So it's that's a lot of walking. So let me read starting in verse 41. Now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the Feast of Passover. And when he was 12 years old, they went up according to custom. And when the feast was ended, as they were returning, the boy stayed behind in Jerusalem. And his parents did not know it. But supposing him to be in the group, they went a day's journey, and then they began to search for him among the relatives and the acquaintances. And when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem searching for him, and after 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions, and all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. And when his parents saw him, they were astonished. And his mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us so? Behold, your father and I have been searching for you in great distress." And he said to them, "Why were you looking for me? Did you not know that I must be in my father's house?" And they did not understand the saying. He spoke to them, and he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was submissive to them. And his mother treasured up all these things in her heart. And Jesus increased in wisdom, stature, and favor with God. When I, one of the first times I ever preached on a regular basis was when I was in preaching school. There was a little church out east of Lubbock, in a little community called Aka. There's not even a church there now. So they had preaching students from Sunset come out there, and all the time, that was their regular, that's who regularly preached out there. And I told them after 9 months, I preached out there 9 months, and I said, "You know, you're doing a great service to the brotherhood because you're listening to lots of bad sermons. Because you got to preach a certain number of sermons before you get any better." And so they were blessing the brotherhood by listening to bad sermons. But there was an old man there that was, I think, Cindy, don't you think he's probably close to 90? Walter. 94. Guy named Walter Milligan. And Walter was a farmer. And he grew up at Cooper, Texas, out in East Texas. He's born in Mississippi, if I remember. He said that I asked him one time if teenagers ever got into trouble. He said, or mischief. And he said, "Yeah." And he said, "We used to have these arbor meetings." I mean, one reason I thought about this is these the booths, you know, the arbor meetings. And he said that people would take their wagons out to this place where the arbor was at, park their wagons, and they would be preaching away into the night. And they had pallets, blankets, to put the children, when the little kids got sleepy, to take them out, put them in the wagons. And he said that sometimes the older boys would go out there in the darkness and move the children around between the wagons. They'd take one child, put him in somebody else's wagon, and they'd rotate them around.
As a prank?
As a prank. Oh. And so he said, you know, when it was over, it was dark, and so the people just got in their wagon and went home. And the way he put it was, he said, you could hear wagon wheels creaking all night. Because people were having to go to house to find their own kid and also take kids back to where they were supposed to be. Now, I thought about that when you think about this group. Here's the group. And so when you read this in Luke chapter 2, it says the feast is over, verse 43, and they're returning. Jesus stays, and his parents don't know it. It's how? What does it say? How long has it been since they've seen him? A day. They have traveled a day back toward Galilee.
But then they look for
him. Yeah. So at what point do they realize he's not there? Well, what time of the day do you suppose it is that it hits on me? He's not there.
Mine says
evening. Why evening? So yeah. So when they've been traveling, they just assume, well, he's over there with his cousins. That's why we haven't seen him. But when it comes bedtime, where's he going to be sleeping? With mama and daddy. And then they realize, then they start saying, have you seen him? Have you seen him? You wonder, do they even start that night to go back? I don't know. But at least very early the next morning, they're heading back to Jerusalem. Because we left the boy. And then they search how long in Jerusalem. So now it's the fourth day. That actually the fifth. Why would I say the fifth? They've traveled one day, so it takes another day to get back to Jerusalem. That's 2 days, and then 3 days. Yeah. So 5 days. That's how long Jesus has been around there at the temple.
What if they get an Amber Alert?
No Amber Alerts, no. I guess. I don't care. Or maybe they don't have good cell service. So they search for him. Notice in verse 44 it says they began to search for him among the relatives and the acquaintances, is the way mine puts it. How does yours put it?
Relatives
and friends. So that tells you who makes up the traveling, the caravan. And so they've not found him. Have you seen him? Have you seen him? No. And so after 3 days, verse 46, they find him in the temple. And what is his posture? He's sitting in the middle of it. That's kind of interesting because that posture can be the posture of a teacher. Look at Matthew chapter 5. Well, actually, stay in Luke here first. Look at Luke 19. So Luke 19, verse 47, Jesus teaches daily in the temple. It says, chapter 21, Jesus is teaching in the temple, chapter 21, 37 and 38. So they're in Luke. But look back at Matthew 5, verse 1. Look at Matthew 5, verse 1. So here are when you read right at the end of chapter 4 of Matthew, there are big crowds of people following Jesus. But then it says Jesus goes up on the mountain. And who does it say follows him? It doesn't say the crowds follow him. Who does it say follows him? The disciples. And so he begins to teach in Matthew 5, verse 1. What is his posture? He's sitting. The posture for a teacher in the ancient world was city.
Did the students stand?
I take it that they stand. But that at what, you know, body language can communicate something. And their practice was actually the opposite. Usually we have the teacher stand, the people are sitting. How does that change the dynamics if the people are standing and the teacher sits?
One It's a Socratic method.
Okay, it's a Socratic method, and that's what you're. I think that's what we're hearing in Luke chapter 2, is that is because there's a lot of asking of questions, and the Socratic method, and if you've got experience with like attorneys are taught that you one way you learn things is you start asking questions, interrogation. Look at Luke chapter 4 also. You remember when Jesus goes back to Nazareth? This is Luke chapter 4, verse 16. So he goes back to Nazareth. This is the adult Jesus. He goes back to Nazareth where he grew up. And and it says that it was as his custom. That's kind of interesting. Wonder where he learned that custom. I think it's his parents. That was his custom. He went to the synagogue on Sabbath day. And what's the first thing he does? He stands up to read. What happens next? Notice. Verse 17, the scroll of the prophet. So they have an attendant in the synagogue who's in charge of the scroll. So this guy hands Jesus the scroll. This week they've got the marker there of where they're at, and they're reading from Isaiah. And so he reads from Isaiah 61. Now, look at verse 20. When he finishes reading from Isaiah 61, what does he do? He rolls it back up, and then what does he do with the scroll? He gives it to the guy that's in charge of the scroll. And he sits down. And what does he begin to do?
Teach.
He stands to read, but he sits to teach. And notice he says in verse 21, what you just heard is being fulfilled in me. And initially the people say, oh, that's interesting. And then they say, they decide to respond. And they respond, they ultimately decide to respond with rocks. They try to kill him. But my point is that you've got, at least in some instances, what the posture of sitting would indicate is teaching. So come back to Luke chapter 2. No. Yeah. So what teaching is he is applying what they have heard. He is, if you see what he does, that's the teaching aspect of it. They've heard the word, and now he's teaching in that he makes application. That's a good question. He makes application of what they has been heard, what was read. Is it what?
A scroll like a letter?
No, a scroll would be, so it's got two rods.
So it's like a document.
Yeah, it's a document. And it you roll it on both ends. And so when you want to get to a place, you roll this one this way and this one this way, and you move back. You can move back and forth and find your place in that writing. One of the technological innovations, by the way, in the first century that was just beginning to be used was a transition beyond the scroll to what's called a codex, which is basically a book. And if you think of, this is just for free, but if you think about how that would change Bible study or listening Bible, how easy is it to find things in a book compared to a scroll? So it's a lot of it's a lot more effort to find your place in a scroll. And so one way to think about that is it was a technological innovation. So the idea of a book that is the bound pages, because you can move back and forth in those pages a lot easier than you can rolling a scroll. And the indications are some of the early adopters of this technology were Christians. But if you think about it, it has an effect. It makes it a different kind of study possible, because you can get to the site faster. So let's look at this. So they find him, and notice verse 46. 3 days they find him, and he is sitting right in the middle of the teachers. That's teaching posture. And he's sitting with them. Now, it's possible that's just incidental, but I think it's... worth asking the question, is he holding his own among the teachers?
They were amazed.
Yeah, because see that the Socratic method is you ask questions. And notice the order of what this says is they're amazed at his understanding and his answers. Why? Well, he is listening to them and asking them questions. That is a teaching method, asking questions. Is he actually teaching the teachers? I think that's at least a possibility you might want to struggle with a little bit. Is he actually teaching the teachers? And that's what's amazing to them, that they are amazed at his understanding at age 12.
And his answers.
Because the way this goes is, so you would ask a question, listen to the answers, and then you would respond to their answers. Maybe with another question, maybe you would explain a little bit more or add something to what they said. But there clearly is an interaction going on between the teachers at the temple and this young man at age 12. And I think this goes back to what we read at the very end of verse 52, and really what we saw earlier in verse 40. You notice those are kind of bookends, verse 40 and verse 52, that speak of his progress. His growth. Does it include these teachers that are there in the temple? Is this an illustration of his point in verse 52? The other thing I would point out, just as we close here, is just, it is interesting, verse 48, that Mary says to him, your father and I. Now, Joseph is not technically his father, but does he function as his father? His earthly father. And so your father and I have been searching for you, and you've caused us a lot of distress. And so his response is, I don't think he's being pertinent, you know, when he says, well, what else, where else would I be? When you got here after that 2-day trip back, you should have been able to find me on the third day. I mean, isn't that his point? But what also is, I think, instructive in verse 51, what does he end up doing? He is submissive to those parents. And he goes with them. What's the alternative? He goes with them back to Galilee, to Nazareth. What would have been the alternative? Stay in the temple. Keep doing what he'd been doing those last 5 days. I think exactly that. I think that's exactly why it said, it stresses here, no, he is going to submit himself to his parents. And he goes back with them to Galilee, to Nazareth. And here's a good question to maybe struggle with a little bit and think about. Is his submission in verse 51 a sign of his growth? His maturity, his increasing maturity. Is submissive, can being submissive be a sign of maturity? So, anyway, anything else as we close? Jesse?
When he asked them questions, would he be asking them questions to see if they knew the answer?
Yeah, I think it's a way of bringing up a topic or a subject and then saying, so how do you read that? You know, what's your read on that? And then he would respond to that after listening to them. That's how I would picture that. There's a give and take there. But the thing that's striking about that is that he seems to be operating on their level and maybe even above their level. Anything else? Okay, thank you. We'll pick up with chapter 3.